Our session this morning is risk margins for life insurance. We have two very nice presenters here, Wau Bui and Brilla Cummings from KPMG. They're going to talk for probably half an hour, which should leave us 20, 25 minutes for questions afterwards. So I think Wau's going to start, and we'll go from there.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the first session of the second day. Congratulations on making it to the graveyard shift, which is 9 o'clock after the dinner last night. This session is about risk margin, but it's not risk margin for capital, which is what we life actuaries are used to. It's risk margin for profit reporting, which is something quite new for us, whereas the general... I know that the general insurance actuary has been working with this for a few years, but I thought it'd be an interesting topic to... Firstly, take you through the context, why we might need risk margin for profit reporting in the future, and how you might go about it. This is not an IASC session, so I will not be covering the accounting context in a lot of detail. There's a session later in the year, in November, that the IASC task force will run, and that will go through a lot more of the subtlety of the issues. But I thought that to say, let's determine risk margin for profit reporting, it doesn't really make sense until you know the key concept behind it. So apologies, but I will take you through some accounting standard first thing in the morning, but there's not very much we can do about that. We will. I'll go through that first, and then my colleague, Brylan Cummings, she will go through one of the key methods, which is the cost of capital, and we'll show you an example and some numbers that come out of it, and we do also the risk margin on the quantile method for risk product, and we'll show you what comes out of that as well. If we have time, I'd like to just take you through 2 minutes of what the general insurance experience has been with risk margin, because I thought there might be some learnings that we can take out from there. In May of 2007, the second phase of the IFRS Phase 2 officially kicked off, with the discussion draft being issued by the International Accounting Standard Board. And the Institute of Actuaries has made a submission to that to the International Accounting Standard Board. But the keystone of the IASB proposal is a three-building block for determining insurance liabilities. Firstly, your liabilities need to have current market consistent probability weighted estimate, which we life actually think of as the best estimate liability. The second plank is it should be a discounted value, which we already know and already practicing it, discounting at risk-free rate. But the third plank of it we're not familiar with, and that's the one I'd like to spend a bit of time talking about today, that's the risk margin. And it's important to take a couple of minutes just to look at what is the risk margin for. It is not for solvency. It is the risk margin that market participants require for bearing risk. There's been a lot of international literature done on this topic already, and I've put up four of the key work. A lot of our examples are built on techniques that are discussed in those papers, and it is in our bibliography, so you don't need to take them down. But some of those techniques we've taken a bit further than in the paper, and more importantly, we've taken it and applied the Australian context to it. The three building block that I talked about earlier is referred to as the exit value model. So it's basically what a person or a company would pay for the liabilities if they had to take, would want to receive, if they had to take the liabilities on as well. So the purpose of risk margin is not to provide a shock absorber, it's to provide margins around the uncertainties of the central estimate. And that introduced a concept, a very important concept, which is until now not used in general insurance risk margins in Australia. It's a concept of reference company. So in looking at the risk margin, you're not to look at just your portfolio. You're looking at the risk margin for a reference company, the company that's going to take over that, the hypothetical company that's going to take over that liability. Although in practice, sometimes the best evidence, or we believe that the best evidence of that, is still your, still start with your own experience. And the other important concept is that unlike IFRS 1, when your unit of account is a contract, in IFRS 2, the unit of account is a portfolio, not a contract. It's necessary because insurance doesn't make sense at a contract level. The next two slides, I'll go through very quickly, but what I want to bring out in the two slides is just a really quick comparison of what your profit emergence might look like under an exit value model. If those of you who attended the ISC briefing last year would have seen a more basic version of this already. But basically, at the moment in MOS, if you have a profitable contract, you're meant to hold the profit margin and spread it and release it over the life of the policy. So the pink line is your profit margin release. It sits above the zero line. So you have a profitable contract, it releases profit nicely over the term. But under IFRS, because there is no reference to premium when you work out your risk margin, it is quite possible that your risk margin is going to be less than your profit margin, or it might be more, but it won't be the same except by coincidence, right? Because you're not referencing your premiums at all. So then what you quite possibly would happen is that you have a profit or a loss at inception. And the profit or loss is equal to the excess of the profit margin over the risk margin. So it's a little bit like releasing your EV profit up front, less a bit of for the risk margin, and then if experience turn out as expected, then your risk margin will come out over the term of policy. And of course the blue line is where what happened when you have a contract that make a loss. It will come out at the start as well. And when you have an assumption change, the present value of the assumption change will come out at the time you change the assumption, unlike the MOS situation where you can spread it out over the future. I'm going to ask Brylan to come up and talk to you about the cost of capital method, which is one of the key methods to determine risk margins under the IFRS 2.
Good morning. The ISB hasn't actually prescribed what method should be used to calculate risk margins. Instead, they've set out a series of guidelines and characteristics. The guidelines include things like risk margins should be explicit, not implicit. Risk margins should reflect all the risks of the shareholder and none of the risks of the policyholder, all the way down to things like the risk margin should be implementable at a reasonable cost. The characteristics it said should be have for risk margins include things like long-duration products should have higher risk margins than short-duration products, and the less you know about the risk, the higher the risk margin should be. The industry currently has two favourites for calculating the risk margin. The first is the cost of capital method, which I'll go through, and the second is the quantile methods or confidence interval methods, which Hua will go through. Interestingly, two methods have been ruled out as being suitable for calculating risk margins on the basis that they have implicit, not explicit margins, and these are the US GAAP provision for deviation and implicit margins or conservative estimates. I'll just take you through the cost of capital methodology now. The cost of capital methodology is basically compensation for having to hold the capital. So a reference company has bought your portfolio, they need to hold capital against it, and they should be compensated for having to hold that capital. So simply speaking, it's the discounted value of the difference between what the purchasing company would require as the rate of return on the capital and what it could earn at the risk-free rate, or essentially the opportunity cost it's giving up by holding that capital. This diagram here sort of sets out how the cost of capital is calculated. So the blue box is your bell. The risk margin is calculated on top of that, and on top of that you've got your capital. So the cost of holding the capital in any particular year will be your opportunity cost, or the 6%, which is the return the company requires over and above the risk-free rate, multiplied by the capital of 20, giving you a cost of capital of 1.2 in the first year. You then build this up over time, so that in the first year, your cost of capital is 1.2. In the second year, you're holding a slightly lower capital as your business runs off, and your cost of capital comes down to 1.14. All the way down to in year four, we see where you're holding 17 capital, your cost of capital is 1.02. You discount those that cost of capital stream at a risk-free rate to give you your risk margin at time zero. So you can see that as you project your portfolio, you're projecting what capital you require at any point in time, working out what the cost of holding that capital is and discounting that back to give you your risk-free rate. One of the chief criticisms that's been levied at the cost of capital method is that it's circular. And I'll just get back to the original picture to show you this. If we think about starting off with our bell, and then we calculate our capital, which would be 25, we then calculate our risk margin based upon that. So our risk margin based upon a cost of capital of 25 would be maybe 7.5. Well, immediately our capital's changed because our capital is no longer 25. Our capital would now be 17.5. Oh, we've now got to calculate the risk margin again because our risk margin depends upon the capital. We calculate our risk margin again, our capital changes. So you can see it's an iterative process. We think in reality this could be quite a lengthy iterative process the first time it's calculated, but once you've calculated it the first year, the second year, you should have a pretty good idea of what your cost of capital is and what your capital, what that sort of difference is, and so you should be able to get to it quite quickly. The other thing is that for modern risk products, many of them, the difference between the bell and the policy liability versus the capital will be very small, and so calculating your risk margin based upon capital above bell versus capital above policy liability could be only a very immaterial difference, and so companies may not need to bother going through the iterative process. The second thing I want to talk about is what rate should be used as the cost of capital. The cost of capital framework is a risk-based framework, so it's assuming that all your risk is embodied in the capital that you're holding, that the capital should take into account all the risks affecting the portfolio. The cost of capital rate, therefore, shouldn't particularly vary between companies because a reference company, whether it's buying company A's portfolio, company B's portfolio, company C's portfolio, it shouldn't be adjusting that rate for the risk of the portfolio because all that risk should already be embodied in the capital which it will need to hold for those portfolios. The second item, though, is more interesting. It's whether or not the cost of capital rate should be dynamic or stationary. If we think back about how the required rate of return of companies has changed over the last sort of, well, in my working lifetime, 10 years, it's changed quite a bit. But has it changed just because the underlying risk-free rate has changed? Or has the opportunity cost component changed as well? If the opportunity cost component has changed, then what is it pegged to? If we were to make it a dynamic, we'd need to peg it to something. And what is an appropriate item to peg it to? These are things which we'll need to sort of think about as an industry and come to decisions on. The answers are not immediately apparent to us. The last item, which sort of is the variable in the cost of capital framework, is what capital to use. There are two immediate options, which are the economic capital or the statutory capital. I'll just use the next diagram to go through these. This example shows the profit release. You can see the pink line is the MOS profit, which of course shows no profit release at inception and the gradual release of the profit margins over time. The red line is what we might have with IFRS 2 if we based upon economic capital. In this example, the risk margins were less than the profit margins, so we get a profit release at inception and a gradual release over time. However, if we now base it upon statutory capital, the capital requirement is much, much higher, so the risk margin is correspondingly much, much higher. So whereas before we were releasing profit at inception, now we actually have to put money in to support those much higher risk margins, and so we get a big loss at inception and then a higher release of profit over time. The question one then asks is, well, is this reasonable? This is a good profitable contract. is it reasonable that we could be in a situation where we're having losses at inception to support higher profit releases over time? The answer to that is, well, if we don't think it's reasonable, then we have two options. One, we could go down the economic capital path. Or secondly, we could have a think about what statutory capital actually embodies. So in the example before, we used a flat 6% rate, the cost of capital on everything. But statutory capital, if we think about it, could be thought of as having two layers of capital. The first layer of capital is the economic capital, which could be seen as quite high risk. And the second layer of capital is the difference between the statutory capital and, is the difference between the economic capital and the statutory capital, which could be seen as being a much lower risk of capital, that we're very unlikely to actually have to need that capital. And so perhaps we require a lower rate of return on that, perhaps 2% rather than the 6%. And this could be this sort of two-layer capital or two-layer risk margin on the two-layer cost of capital approach could be used to give a much more intelligent result rather than that big loss at inception. The final thing I want to talk about is the whole concept of the reference company with regards to the cost of capital method. Just get back to the first slide again. As Hua said earlier, everything that you have to think about is sort of thought of in the concept of the reference company. So the cost of capital rate is the cost of capital is the rate which the reference company would require to justify the capital that it's holding. That's a key thing, the capital that it's holding. So when you calculate the capital that you're holding, you should calculate it in a reference company concept, not necessarily your own concept. So when you go through all those margins that you're holding for the capital adequacy liability on your mortality, lapses, expenses, you should think about them in a reference company concept, not necessarily your own reporting company concept. So would the reference company have better claim management processes? Would they have lower, would they have lower risk of expenses? All those things. This is a theoretical issue, but perhaps it's not actually a practical issue. As Hua mentioned earlier, the best idea of what a reference company might experience is perhaps going to be your own experience, not hypotheses about what a reference company may or may not experience. I'll now hand over back to Hua to take you through the quantile method.
Hi. I should mention before I start on the second method that the profit at inception issue is still very contentious in terms of the international thinking about it, and the IASB actually acknowledges that. It hasn't come to a conclusion or a majority view as to whether there should be profit at inception or not. The other way that you can set risk margin is what we're already familiar with, the quantile method. The quantile method is basically saying you need a risk margin so that your probability of ruin is a lot less than 50%. In the case of CABAT, we're used to working with a probability of ruin of 1 over 400 years. And in general insurance, the probability of ruin there is 25%. In the following example, what we'll do is we'll use a 75% probability of sufficiency for profit reporting. Now, we haven't done any work in particular to choose the 75. We just thought it's in between 50 and 99.5. Don't be too excited about the 75. But I have seen some work overseas that suggests it should be about two-thirds. So 75 is actually not too far off. I'm going to go through the steps, but I think you're all aware of these steps, which is, firstly, you're starting from the bottom up. You're looking at your portfolio and the risk that surrounds your central estimate. So you think about anything that would introduce uncertainty into your best estimate liabilities. And then you think of each of the components of them separately. So you look at mortality, uncertainty, morbidity, uncertainty, lapses, expenses, and so on. Then for every one of those uncertainty, you model the uncertainty in some way. You could do it stochastically or using a probability of distribution functions. Or you can invent a new way. And then what you need to do is also think about aggregating the risk across products, and also there might be possibly some overlap between component of the mortality risk, for instance. When you're aggregating across product, a very contentious issue is how much diversification benefit you should allow for. If you went to the IAS, the task force presentation yesterday, effectively for capital, the task force is saying you should be allowed for quite a bit of diversification across product. So overseas, there's been a lot of discussions about this. The ISB position currently is that you should not allow for any diversification, but the Institute of Actuaries' position is that that is not sensible, because your reference company would most likely be a very large company with a diversified portfolio, and therefore a diversification benefit should be allowed for. But you can imagine that if you did allow for diversification benefit, that's a major source of differences between companies, unless you can define the reference company in a lot of detail. So it's something to think about. For the next example, what I'm going to do is just to show you some numbers that come out of a little exercise that we do to quantify the random volatility risk margin, the uncertainty around the level of the best estimate, and also the trend uncertainty. We haven't done anything for the pandemic or the concentration risk at the moment. I think pandemic is rightly allowed for in capital. The concentration risk, which affects a lot of group life business, we just simply ran out of time. The table behind you shows the risk margin at two level of sufficiency, 75%, which is notionally our profit reporting level, and then 99.5%, which is notionally your capital adequacy. We've done it for four portfolio. The top one is what I think of as the reference company, so a very large portfolio, reasonably skewed, but not too badly. It has a reasonable standard deviation. And the next three are, I guess, a range of companies that you might be considering as your reporting entity. So if you have a really small portfolio, your random volatility risk margin might be 5%, as opposed to the reference company of 1.5%. Now, the thinking is that in an exit value model, you should be thinking of the random fluctuations margin in the context of a reference company. And these numbers show you that, firstly, that it makes a lot of difference whether you use a reference company or your own, or it could make a lot of difference. And the second observation I'd make is that the 99.5% is broadly consistent is what we think of as mortality or part of the mortality margin. To look at the risk margin for level uncertainty, our approach was to consider the number of observations that you have in the experience study that lets you come up with your best estimate liability. So, for example, if you've got a very big portfolio and you've got 500 claims expected in a year, and you've done it over 3 years, which is a usual period to do your experience analysis on, then you're looking at the sort of uncertainty around 1,500 claims, and it might give you perhaps 1.5% to 2% risk margin. Of course, those of you who've done these numbers will know that you have to make a range of assumptions to get there. You need to make the assumptions that the deaths are Poisson distributed, they are there's enough of them to make the sum of them normally distributed, and so on and so on. And that's, I guess, that's one of the key discomfort that we have when we start trying to model every individual risk margin and uncertainty, is that you need to, along the way, make quite a few assumptions. I mean, a lot of actuaries make those assumptions in general insurance too, but it's an observation that you do need to satisfy a lot of conditions, and often when your portfolio gets very small, it isn't actually true, but the validation doesn't always occur. If, say, you're a very small company and you need to base a lot of your best estimate liability on industry experience or reinsurance decrements, then there is theoretically another level of uncertainty that is introduced and you should allow for, which is how much different your own portfolio would be compared to the industry or the reinsurance portfolio. the third level of uncertainty is whether or not you've allowed sufficiently for the trends when you look at past experience and then try and project it to your future experience. To do these, one of the study that we've seen overseas suggests that you look at 20 years' worth of mortality and try and observe the errors through that. And we thought 20 years is a very long time, and it actually is probably unrealistic, because when you look at trends for your own portfolio, you don't usually look that for that such a long time. I'm lucky if I have 10 years of actual company experience anyway. I don't know about yours, but so what we've done in this example is we took, just to give you an idea of what numbers that would come out, we took 10 years worth of QXs from the Australian Life Table by age. And for every 3 years rolling period, we worked out what we would expect when we set the best estimate liability for the fourth year. And then we compare that with the actual observations, because we're looking back, we can tell what actually happened. And if you repeat that across the 10 years period, you can build up a number of observations which lets you build an actual distribution function so you can work out the 75th percentile. So the results are on the board, and the paper actually goes through the steps a bit more detail. But the result shows that the risk margin for trend uncertainty using sort of 3 years rolling averages gives you about 7%. So it's not an unreasonable amount of margin. I expect that when you do it for real, you're probably missing some ages and you need to do some graduation to fill it in. Group life is a very big and growing experience of the mortality uncertainty. And what we've done here is really, really roughly have a think about what is the key uncertainty in a group life liability. And we believe that the key uncertainty is basically in how quickly you can run off your portfolio, your IBNR portfolio. So to come up with those first cut margins, what we've done is taken two industry funds of medium size, between 5 and 10 million each, and we've applied the MAC method to the IBNR triangles. An interesting observation is that it shows that the death triangle seemed to always have a higher degree of variance than the TPD. And so those two columns on the left shows you the sort of margins that come out if you use 15% covariance for death and TPD combined. It gives you about 9% in risk margin. And if you use a different covariance coefficient of variance for TPD and death, then you get not much of a difference. Actually, that's a surprising result. But so it's the risk margin is actually not sensitive to what you assume in terms of covariance. And it is also quite consistent with the solvency risk margin at the moment. But that exercise that we've done for Group Life is, I think it needs a lot more work in terms of actually looking at the data and seeing whether what the MAC method gives you is adequate, because MAC method is a general insurance technique which is used often by the general insurance actuaries to get a first cut feel for how much variance there is in your actual data. And so you really need to examine your data as well. I got a general insurance actuary to look at the runoff, and he said that he would personally use 25% for everything. So that gives you a bit of an idea. I'll quickly go through this slide. In general insurance, insurers have had to hold risk margin for capital purposes, for solvency purposes, at 75% probability of sufficiency for some years now, and the AASB 1023 require risk margin for uncertainty since 2002. But the surprising observation for me is that in the general insurance world, companies report at higher probability of sufficiency for profit reporting as they do for solvency. QBE, for instance, published in the annual report that the probability of sufficiency for profit reporting was 94%, and so does Suncorp. Whereas, as I said about 5 minutes earlier, I would have thought that in a realistic reporting world that you would want your profit reporting probability of sufficiency to sit between 50% and 99.5%. In terms of methodology, there's still a range of methodology being used, a range of stochastic and deterministic methodologies, and also there's quite a reliance on using research paper margins as a starting point. APRA did a survey in 2005 on consistency between the risk margins between companies and found that while there is consistency between products, so the longer tail have higher margins, there is quite a bit of variations in the risk margin between companies, and it's not sure, because the APRA survey covers net of reinsurance and it covers after risk margin after diversification benefits, it's not sure, it's not certain whether those variations is due to reinsurance differences and diversification benefit differences. So what have we taken out of the paper? We've got some issues to consider further and some observations and result. The issues to consider further is the concept of reference company and where it should apply when you set your risk margin. The cost of capital method raises a few questions. What rate should be the cost of capital? And also what capital should be used in the cost of capital method? I guess both of those issues we didn't expect to come out until we actually did the numbers. The quantile method raises a number of questions themselves as well. As you can see there, we need to think about how to model all the product, annuities, IBNRs for group life and GSC and so on. And also, how do you allow for diversification between products and between risk? We do have some conclusions. Conceptually, I find both methods are quite conceptually satisfactory. However, in terms of application, it is a lot easier to apply the cost of capital once you've resolved the two issues that I mentioned before. The cost of capital method, though, really needs a coherent risk-based framework. And it also, I think, is based on the assumption that the risk-based capital works, the rules that the regulators set actually have to work well for both small and large company. If it doesn't work well for a small company, for instance, then to base the whole risk margin on that would be defeating the purpose, and you might still miss risk that you haven't allowed for appropriately. And the other takeout that I have from the paper is that the magnitude of the risk margin doesn't come out too bad. It does seem to be sort of sensible about the sort of thing that you expect.
Thank you very much for that presentation. We have probably 10 or 15 minutes of questions if people like to ask questions. I could ask if you keep your questions short, given the time left. There is a roving mic around, usual things. State your name beforehand because it is recorded. So do we have any questions from the floor?
I'd be interested in your thoughts on the interaction between this and some solvency regimes around the world. So if this basically has a best estimate liability and some risk margins, that looks to me pretty similar as what the FSA requires for some of their work. So effectively you have your realistic liability plus you have to go through your scenario or your stochastic risks. So I was just wondering if you had any thoughts about how they would interact, and when we finally get to implementation mode, would you just use a lot of the work you've done already for the FSA or equivalent solvency type work?
Absolutely. This framework for IFRS 2 relies on having a realistic and risk-based capital framework around it. So, it does fit very well. And that was one of the key issues that came out of the European work as well, Richard. So, let's say you've used the quantile method to determine your risk margin for capital, then I don't see why you wouldn't use the same with a lower probability of sufficiency for profit reporting.
With the exception that you'll have to think of it in terms of the reference company concept, so issues like stochastic risk, which might be very important for solvency, might have no importance whatsoever for the risk margins for profit reporting.
It would be interesting where the diversification debate ends up, because that's well entrenched for solvency, but if it's not going to be used for IFRS balance sheet liability, then that would certainly push up the liability for IFRS compared with solvency.
That is by no means a closed debate. That was one of the two very contentious issues in the submission to the IASB in May. So, yep, that's ongoing.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to make a couple of observations. I mean, firstly, I think it's important to remember that what we're trying to do here is to determine the cash that a potential purchaser would require to take on the risk. So I think what's key here is the risk that's embedded in the cash flows we're talking about. And whichever method you use, whether it's cost of capital or quantile or whatever capital you use, you should get back to the same answer. They're just a means to getting to that result. From a personal perspective, I'm actually in favour of the cost of capital approach. And there's a big push in Europe to align the cost of capital approach with Solvency II. And why is that? That's so that you can build a, if you like, a financial framework where your profit reporting, solvency reporting, and value reporting is all aligned and becomes. And if you can do that, you can really build a powerful risk management tool, one where reductions in risk help all of those financial metrics at the same time, or conversely, where risk increases, they hinder them all at the same time. So that's why I favour that approach.
I would agree with everything that Mike just said there, and I would add that in the latest guidance note that came out of the International Actuarial Association on risk margin and current estimate, they lean very heavily towards the cost of capital method without actually saying that you shouldn't do it any other way. So, certainly that's the way of the future. That's why we spend so much time on those slides.
I'd just like to ask a couple of questions. And firstly, I'd like to go back to the accounting standard, with the quotation you had. And this has actually got nothing to do with this paper, I don't think. But you talked about the central estimate being equivalent to the current best estimate work. My understanding is probability-weighted means that you're using the mean of all the possible cash flows, probability-weighted, whereas best estimate currently tends to take 2-3 years experience and look at what they've been. So, for example, with mortality, you'd have to allow for a pandemic within the probability weighted calculations, which leads to sort of quite different type of work than we do at the moment. The other possibility that brings up is if you've got a very likely but very large thing like a pandemic, it leads to the spectre of, if you use the second method, of negative risk margins. And that's actually contemplated in the general insurance standard, and I think, although it doesn't say you can't have them, it severely discourages them. And I just wondered how you'd deal with those. And just the third question is, I would just have a concern that if different organisations do using different methodology, they'll come up with different answers, even though theoretically they shouldn't, and that will lead to a lack of comparability.
Thank you for the question. There are a host of issues surrounding current estimates that I didn't actually go into. So you're quite right. There will be subtle differences between the way that we think of best estimate liability now and the way that we need to consider current estimates in the future. And I guess we didn't have time to cover that today, but you're quite correct, there are subtleties. I guess I just want to make one comment in terms of the word probability weighted. In accounting world, sometimes liability can be determined without considering the probability weighted approach. So, for instance, for some liabilities, you could just decide whether it's likely or not likely, and if it's not likely, you don't have to hold anything. And so the probability weighted point there is to say, if it's there are five outcomes and each of them are unlikely because they're 20% each, you still have to allow for them all. So that's the context of the probability weighted word in the accounting standard. In terms of your concern, I definitely share that. I think without a prescribed method, it's quite possible that you use the same method and come up with completely different margins. And that's actually one of the positive that has been attributed to the cost of capital, because all companies will have to use the same capital requirement, and so coming up with the... It's very hard to come up with different risk margin using the cost of capital. At least you have some commonality in methodology there.
Michael Gardner, I'm just curious about whether this is sort of manipulative, whether an unscrupulous shareholder could just... Now, have the actuary play with the margin slightly and just generate a different profit margin for the year and do this for several years in a row without anybody apparently seeing it, because probably the amount that's actually going to be published by the company is going to be pretty minimal, so none of us can actually see through to what's happening.
I can only speculate, but I can give you my two cents worth. I think disclosure is going to be a very big part of the future world. When IFRS 2 aligns with Solvency 2 or some sort of version of IFRS 2 capital in Australia. So I'm expecting that the risk margin will need to be disclosed, and that would act as a deterrent to fiddling with them without proper reasons. And I guess your auditor has something to do with it as well. So I guess you have to convince some people about why you changed the risk margin this year and not last year.
Yeah, my understanding on the general insurance side, they do disclose their probability sufficiency in their accounts. So I'd imagine if you're a shareholder and you see the probability sufficiency changing significantly from year to year, especially if you're a researcher or analyst of the thing, you would look at that to try to work out how much reserves that they released and affecting the profit. So I could imagine the same type of thing would happen on the life insurance side. From a disclosure point of view,
I think another benefit of the risk margins, which we didn't quite bring out, is the fact that with Moz, although intuitively it can feel good because we're smoothing everything over time, if you go into loss, then you're actually just holding best estimate liability, and that's a very volatile thing. And it's also there's no margin at all in there, which can feel, well, it feels to me quite low. So the key advantage of the risk margin method is that you're always going to have a margin in there to reflect the higher value that you should be holding on your balance sheet over and above Bell.
The shareholder then thinks that's a hollow log, and therefore, if you have a bad year, you can release some of it.
You still have to convince the auditor.
I'll probably ask a question just to extend from Michael's thing, and maybe people here with general insurance experience can probably tell me. I understand the probability of sufficiency in a general insurance company is something which is semi-decided by the directors of the company. I don't know if anyone can confirm or deny that. So to the extent that if we did go to a probability sufficiency approach for a life insurance company, it does allow the directors to some extent manipulate the profit a little bit. But to the extent that that is disclosed and any changes in those probabilities disclosed, it would allow people to adjust their profit accordingly to work out what's going on there. But the issue is that it then creates hard to compare companies to companies, as it is for general insurance companies at the moment, because although some of the big ones keep very close probability sufficiencies to each other, others could have much lower. And therefore, it's very difficult to work out what's actually happening. But then again, that's IFRS type stuff anyway. You can't work out what's going on.
I guess it's one of the advantages of the cost of capital method is that because you have fewer variables and those variables which you have are sort of the cost of capital rate, which could be prescribed by APRA, and the capital itself, which will then have auditors looking at it and APRA looking at it, there's less opportunity for something like that to go on.
I'm quite happy to ask you questions.
Maybe I can make some comments to stimulate discussions. What do you think of the concept of a reference company for profit reporting? Is it a relevant concept? Is it sensible to have your own liability determined using a reference company? Because that's never been done in Australia, certainly not in general insurance. It's a major departure from what we know of. Any views?
I suppose I'll throw in the view in that if APRA or whatever says that you as a company need to hold a certain amount of capital adequacy and solvency, and yet for financial reporting you're using a completely different capital requirement, I think that would cause a lot of confusions among shareholders.
I just think one thing is important to remember in all this, that under IFRS you're not valuing the company or the company. You split up the company and value different parts of it. So what you're valuing here are some insurance contracts, and that's intended to be outside the context of all the other assets and liabilities of the organisation. So if a company owns a building, it would be valued as a building, as value in the marketplace, not its value to that company. So that's the same reason why I think the original discussion paper did not allow for diversification, and why there was a sort of a distancing from the valuation for financial reporting than the valuation for other purposes, which were more in the company context.
I suppose the other thing going from that is if you do buy a portfolio at the risk margin, then by the time you consolidate it into your own portfolio, you may end up with a different risk margin depending on your capital requirements, and therefore you may end up with a significant profit or loss on actually buying a portfolio.
Hi, I'm Wan Saiful from Malaysia, the regulator for the insurance companies. Well, in Malaysia, we're actually embarking on a risk-based capital, which we would like to streamline it to the IFRS as well. And we've been doing about 1.5 years of testing of, you know, using, we've actually adopting the quantile approach in coming up with risk margins. And we find that my personal view would be it's quite difficult to have it to use a reference company concept, because it's arbitrary to actually adjust how your individual company's experience in relation to a reference company unless you do your own experience analysis and then you justify it. And then if you're actually doing your own experience analysis, why don't you just use that, you know, to set your own risk margin? And another point that we'd like to share is the point on a diversification of products. At the early stage, we thought, you know, there should be diversification benefit of selling different kind of products. But based on the testing, we arrive at a crossroad whether we should allow diversification or not, because different products, let's say for a product which is lapse supported, where it's loss-making, so the more people lapse on it, the better it is for the product. But there's other products which is profitable. So when you want to set your lapse assumption or risk margin uncertainty on your lapse, do you set it on the same direction? Well, the answer is, the logical answer is probably no, because people who are buying the loss, who are still in the loss-making product of the company, probably have a value for that policy, because from an option point of view, the policyholders are in the money. So it doesn't really make sense if, let's say, you assume the same lapse assumption for two different type of products where it could actually, the value to policyholders is actually different.
Thank you for sharing that. Can I just ask, in Malaysia, do you use risk margin for profit reporting or capital?
Well, we haven't started using it. The implementation is on 1st of January 2009, but we'll be using the same concept for both, yeah, the capital and solvency, because we find it quite costly for companies to do accounts on two different bases and all that, and we just want to minimise the cost of business as well.
My name is Paul Swinhoe. Well, I'll take up your challenge on the reference company. It strikes me that the IFRS started off with the concept that it'd like to measure the market value of liabilities and is gradually getting realistic. When they're retail liabilities within a life company, it's too hard to tell what their market value is, so let's come up with a pragmatic way of addressing them that meets our needs as best as possible. To my mind, the reference company is on the unrealistic side of the line. It's just too hard. You spend enough time looking at your own company, and therefore that is the benchmark that you would be using. I think allied to a cost of capital approach, then you're already on the looking at my own company's point of view, and it would be consistent to do that. Your own assumptions, your own approach to risk, your own approach to cost of capital would all be consistent with your own company's experience rather than a reference company. I guess the other solution is to deem your company to be the reference company. But you may have people that will gainsay that. Since I got the mic, I'll go on to make one of the other comments.
You've got to be
quick, Paul. I think the method still has the weakness that you're going to capitalise changes in interest rates, which is generally seen as a nonsense for YRT products with non-guaranteed premium rates. I don't hold out any expectation that will change, but still leaves us with the difficulty of explaining results to management when interest rates change, and they think that you pay your claims out of your premiums and we keep what's left over. I like the cost of capital method because it means that you make a loss when you do bad things like sell particularly annuities and disability income that do not return your cost of capital. At the moment, they can be profitable because they've got an internal rate of return somewhere between the risk-free rate and your shareholder rate. And this will bring those chickens home to roost. And lastly, people look at cost of capital, including imputation credits, and I haven't yet figured out how to bring imputation credits into this. And you can take that as a question if you want. You can duck it as well if you also want.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for our presenters and a very informative presentation today. So, usual round.